You survived severe burn covering 70% of your body at 18. Could you tell me how this happened and how this influenced your later career?
I can. Before I do, I just want to say that I was reflecting on podcasts today.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought about what kind of a wonderful world this is, that you can ping somebody, cross the ocean, the sea, whatever, and have a discussion with them. Like, you know, like when I was your age, if I wanted to, like, it's kind of an amazing thing that you can reach out to somebody and say, hey, I want to have a call. And that person will say, sure. Most cases, right? They say, sure. And not only that, but podcasts give us permission to jump into real questions. You know, like so much of regular life is small talk and chit chat.
Yes. Yeah.
And all of a sudden, there's a social norm in podcasts to say that, you know, we don't need to do the, you know, let's get to know each other, dance exactly. A little bit. How do you feel? Okay, so I was just thinking what a wonderful mechanism podcasts have been. And, you know, even if nobody watches podcasts, it's not or listens to them, it's just a different way of having a conversation. I think it's just wonderful. Okay, so anyway, you asked about my injury. So I was injured a long time ago. I was in my late teens. As you said, a flare. A flare is a bomb that the military sends up to the sky to light up a battlefield. And mostly magnesium, very, very hot. And one of those got exploded by mistake next to me. Very intense heat. And burns, the depth of the burn, the like first degree, second degree, third degree, is really how deep it is. First degree, some of the skin is gone. Third degree, there's no more skin and you have to do transplants. And everybody had a little burn at some point. And people think, okay, you have a burn, it goes away. It turns out that super limited burns and large burns, superficial burns and deep burns are very different. In my case, there was need for lots and lots of skin transplants.
Yes.
In the early days, my week, they would take, I don't have burns on my upper thighs. So they would take something like a cheese slicer. They would put me to sleep. And they would take this cheese slicer and slice thin skin from my upper thighs. And then they would wake me up. And the next day they would transplant it on a different place. Before they would transplant, they would take a metal brush and they would rub the place that they're going to transplant it, because they wanted to get rid of the dead cells. So if you put skin on dead cells, nothing good happens. You need to rub it to make sure that all the dead stuff is done. And some bleeding is available because blood is also oxygen. And then you would put it, and then 2 weeks later, some of it would catch, some of it wouldn't catch, and 2 weeks later do the same thing. And that's the process. Being a patient is always complex. You know, when people call me these days to talk about their injuries, I usually say, put a timer for 3 years. And people say, no, 3 years is so long.
Yeah.
It ends up being much, much longer than people think. And in my case, and it's true for burn patients, there's the initial stage when there's a life danger. And the life danger is really about infections. Our skin is our biggest organ. It does lots of things. We don't think of it, but it does lots of things. And it protects us from infections. When you don't have it, an infection can really spread very easily and people die. The danger starts, the real life danger starts from about 30%. It burns, I had about 70. But one of the difficult points was that after about a year and a half, I was almost done with my burns being covered. So I almost had no open wounds, some, but you know, not mostly it was over. And what I didn't expect, so you know, there's an improvement, right, in terms of that. And what I didn't expect then was that my skin started shrinking.
Really?
So you know, it's a very bad skin. You know, you just transplant, like when you take with a cheese slicer, the skin has multiple layers that have different functions. They would take only the top layer and a little bit of the middle layer. Because if you take the full layer, it will never grow. And if you take too much, it will never grow. So they take something. So this skin is just not that good skin. It's all transplant. There's no sweat glands. There's not lots of things don't have. Anyway, after a little bit less than a year and a half, I'm kind of almost done with the open wounds. But then the skin starts shrinking. And what I mean is that I would sit with my elbows folded, like watching a movie. Like in the beginning, I was just in bed. So I'm in bed and I'm mostly in a Jesus position. Stretch, arms to the side, head to the back, to stretch the scars as much as possible. Then from time to time, I remember the first time I sat in a chair and my knees are folded, my elbows are folded, and I watch a movie. At the end of the 2 hours, I can't straighten it.
Wow.
It's like this.
Yeah.
Start stretching and stretching and stretching and stretching. A little bit like how kids do Indian burn. And I can't make it. And the physical therapists come and they stretch and they stretch and they stretch. And that became my biggest challenge for the next couple of years, where every time I would let go of being, you know, completely stretched, my skin would stretch and I would then need to undo the work. And sometimes I managed, sometimes I would manage to straighten my arm again, and sometimes I wouldn't. So sometimes it was a little bit less and then a little bit less and then a little bit less. I would lose the battle. And then they would have to do surgery. So if you look at this arm, for example, there's lots of things here because they would cut it and they would put new skin. So I would fail. And my legs are the same thing. My neck is the same thing. So that was a second kind of a battle that was, first of all, I didn't expect it. Nobody prepared me. Everything was about saving life, covering the wounds. Nobody prepared me for the second step of feeling that my body is fighting against me. But it was very, very tough, partly because I didn't expect it, and partly because it was very psychologically devastating to feel that my body was fighting against me this way. Lots more to say about this, but life in hospital, going back to your question, life in hospital is like a magnifying glass on some aspects of humanity. It's a magnifying glass on dealing with pain. It's a magnifying glass of having no control. It's a magnifying glass on trusting other people. It's a magnifying glass on fear. It's a magnifying glass on pain medication. It's a all kinds of things. And I was very, very much concerned with pain. Very, very much wanted to reduce the pain I was having. Initially, it was the pain of the bandage removal, which was incredibly excruciating. But then it moved to other things. And I was looking to improve things. Initially for myself, then I was thinking about things more generally. And when I left the hospital and I started studying psychology, I learned about the experimental method. I learned that I had this amazing professor. He was a double amputee. His tank, his vehicle went over a landmine and he lost both of his legs. He experienced tremendous pain throughout his life. But he had this approach that says, if you have a question, put it to an experiment. We did together my first experiment ever on pain, and then I kept on doing more experiments on pain. And my whole purpose was to figure out how do we improve the human condition. So, you know, if I look at now, many years later, my general approach is to look around, and say, what human endeavor, which domain of life do I think that we're underperforming? We could be here and we're here. Sleep, we could do better. Spending money, we could do better. Hate, we could do better. So I look at different things and I say, where do I think we could do better? And then I say, do I have the tools to prove that we could do better, that we're underperforming, to understand why is it that we don't do better, and then to propose some solutions, test them, make sure I know how to do better. So that has become my mode of operation. I look around and I look for places where I think humanity is underperforming and ways to do things better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned sleep, and how do you think we can improve our sleep, and why are we so bad at, I guess, managing our sleep? You know, so many people stay up too late and then have to wake up super early. What's some ways we can do it?
So sleep is very interesting because we don't have a good sensor for the quality of sleep. Mm-hmm. Like you don't wake up in the morning and you have a very vague sense of your sleep, and you don't have an accurate thing. And then, of course, sleep toll takes a while to show up. And, you know, human beings were very good in understanding deterministic effects. Like, imagine that when you wake up, your quality of sleep would translate to your exact performance the next day. No problem, right? Very quickly, you would say, oh my goodness, if I don't fall asleep, I'll have this. The problem is it's probabilistic. You could have a night when you didn't sleep that much, and the next day you would feel really quite well. And you could do the opposite. You could have a night where you went to sleep early and the next day you feel sluggish. So what happens is that when we have a night, when we don't sleep that much, sometimes we feel like we cheated nature. Look at me. I managed. I stole 3 hours last night. I was effective at night at work. And today I'm just drinking coffee, but slightly just as effective. So we are very good in deterministic models. You come to a room, you turn the switch, light comes up. What would happen if you turn the switch up and light would come up 55% of the time? We would get very, very confused. So when we rely on our intuition about what's good sleep and what's bad sleep, when the world is stochastic and the feedback is delayed, it's not exactly the same day, we dramatically underperform. Mm. And in those cases, what we should do is we should reward ourselves based on what we do, not based on the outcome. So the problem is that we don't have this reward structure. But what you want to do is you want to say, let me create the rules for sleeping well. It would only create good sleep in 55-60% of the time, but it's the right recipe. And it means going to sleep at this hour, and it means not drinking coffee after 4, and it means sleeping with low temperature and heavy blanket and smell of lavender, and there's all darkness and all kinds of things like that. By the way, when people try different things, we usually stop the experiment too quickly. Mm. So imagine, for example, something like a heavy blanket. And imagine I say, Jacob, here's a heavy blanket, go and try it. And let's say you try it for a week and you don't feel better. Would you stop or would you continue? It turns out short experiments are very psychologically pleasing, but they're not correct because it really takes us time to adjust to anything new.
Yeah.
Low temperature, take some time to get used to it. And not drinking coffee after 4, take some time to get used to it. So I think we need to think more about what we do, not about sleep. Like, I wonder how much all these sleep measures, I do one of these too, but I wonder how much all of these sleep measures are helping. I think what we need to do is to think about what we do, not about sleep. Hmm. And I think we need to test more things and for longer.
Hmm. Yeah. And is the reason why we do it so short and we give up so quickly, is that partly just because of the way dopamine acts? So if we don't get that dopamine hit, then we give up.
It's about their intuition. You know, think about almost everything in life. How quickly we think we learn something. You go on a date with somebody and after half an hour, you say, yes or no. You have anything about this person. How dare you make a judgment after half an hour? But we all trust our gut feeling. I try a heavy blanket for 2-3 nights. Nothing happens. I have a very hard time saying, let's continue anyway to try this because something would change. But we need to do those experiments. You know, when people have allergies, for example, the way it used to work out is doctor used to say, stop eating and everything, and then eat one more thing every two weeks. Strawberries, add strawberries, don't do anything else. But we need that discipline for trying new things. For example, I talked to a sleep expert a few weeks ago, and I asked her, you know, what do we know about sleeping together versus sleeping separately? And she said, the truth is not that much.
Is there not much difference in the quality of sleep?
It looks like there's variance. There are more and more people now who are very sleep concerned that have what is called sleep divorce. When they live together and they sleep separately, not because they're not romantically interested, but just because of sleep. But I have to say, you know, this sleep idea that we have, is it capturing everything about sleep? You know, we measure lots of things. We care a lot about REM sleep and deep sleep and so on. Is this everything? She said, we don't know. We don't know. So anyway, there's a lot we don't know. Lots of people are trying to optimize on some things. I think we don't do experiments for long enough, and we reward the outcome, not the process.
And how long should we do these sleep experiments for, ideally?
So you know, this is kind of goes to the question of how long does a new habit comes to? And the question is, when does it become part of our lives and we are comfortable with it? So, you know, sleeping with a heavy blanket takes a little bit of time because it's different and you have to adjust and you might not be able to turn around and so on in the same way. Sleeping in very dark light, relatively easy. Sleeping with a low temperature takes a while to get used to it, you know, what blanket would fit and so on. Stopping to drinking coffee at 4, let's say, takes a while to get used to it. So it's not the one answer fits all. It's really a question of how long does it take us to feel comfortable with something and fully adjust to it. But if you say 3-4 weeks, that's probably long enough for most things.
Yeah. And in general, humans do not act as rational decision makers, but actually are predictably irrational. What actually makes us predictably irrational? What are the reasons for this?
So
wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
So in general, my metaphor for the human mind as a decision-making apparatus is of a vintage Swiss Army knife. Let me break this into two, vintage and Swiss Army. Let's start with the Swiss Army knife. The Swiss Army knife is not particularly good at anything. There's not a single task that you would say, I need a knife let me find a Swiss Army knife. If I need a can opener, let me find a Swiss Army knife. If I need tweezers, let me find it. The Swiss Army knife is not good. It's not excellent at anything. It's quite okay in lots of things. And its greatness is that it's quite okay in lots of things and that we can carry it with us very easily. Our mind is the same thing. Not really excellent in almost anything. AI is proving it to us now very easily. But quite good in lots of things, and we can carry it with us when we go. So that's the first part, the Swiss Army knife. The second element of this metaphor is the vintage. And the idea of the vintage is that our Swiss Army knife was designed under evolutionary period in a very different time. It was designed when we were roaming the savannas. So we have, for example, a sensor for snakes. When you see a snake, you get frightened immediately. You don't need to learn. We inherited it. When we see a tiger, we get afraid. Now, these are very, very useful decision apparatus tools, but a long time ago, it wouldn't be the tools you would create for the modern world. So we have this vintage Swiss Army knife. It was never that good, but now it's not good and not relevant, but that's still what we carry with us. So we carry this set of tools that are designed for snakes and knives and living in a small community. And now we need to live, deal with cryptocurrency and living for 30 years after retirement and choosing a healthcare plan and trusting, somebody from Niger who is sending us an email about being a prince of some sort. And it's just not the right tools. So, and there are kind of two approaches of how to deal with this. One approach, you can think about the approach of cars. Basically, what cars engineers, they look at accident rates every year. They analyze all the accidents and they say, how do we understand human nature and the faults in human nature and make technology cover those up? So they say something like, oh, these people don't understand safety distance. Let's give them a sensor for that. Yeah, these people can't seem to move their heads to the side to look for traffic. Let's do a side mirror. They don't seem to do this. They basically try to understand human weakness and try to get the machine to compensate. That's one approach. The second approach can be thought in general of the approach of social media. Social media, they also get better every year. But the way they get better every year is they also understand human weaknesses, but now they try to take advantage of us.
Yes.
So they say things like, oh, these people seem to have a hot button about gossip. Let's use more gossip. Oh, they prefer more pictures and less this. They prefer more movies and this. They prefer bad things over good things. They prefer emotions over cognitive. They prefer trust over arguments. And they basically do this. So in all cases, we are flawed. And we are flawed physically. And what we've done with our physical flaws is that we build the world around us. We have a hard time standing, so we have chairs. We have a hard time regulating temperature. We have air conditionings and heaters. We have a hard time seeing, so we have glasses. And we don't take people and we say, deal with that. You can't run very fast, deal with it. No, it's happening. Let's give you a car or bicycle or plane. The mental world is the same way. And say, let us understand where we are frail in terms of our mental capacity. And then hopefully we take the car approach and we make things better. But sadly, lots of companies take the social media approach. They look at where we fail and try to take advantage of us. But we need to recognize that we are irrational, frail, or limited. And we need to think about what are we doing with this and how do we compensate. I'll give you a very trivial example. In the US, there are mortgages, and mortgages have this element of interest rate. Very simple. And if I show you two mortgages, one with an interest rate of 4 and one with an interest rate of 3.99, you would know which one is better. But what they did in the US is they added another dimension called points. And points is a way for you to pay up front an amount to reduce your interest rate. Now, guess what? It really confuses people. You add one more dimension and now you say, oh, what is better, a 3.5 interest rate with 1 point that cost me $10,000 or a 4 point interest rate? People get very confused. Now, the people who are doing this, of course, are doing it to confuse people.
Yeah.
But we could do much better. So the point is that, for example, with the interest rate, you can imagine a tool that would get people to easily solve this problem. We just don't do it.
Yeah. But what tool would you suggest?
So, for example, if you had a web interface that says, how long do you plan to keep this mortgage? Or you could even say, on average, people in this economic term, the interest rate is quite high right now. We hope it would go down. We can assume 3 years on average, but you know, what is your take? Do you plan to keep it more or less? And you would give an answer. And then I could say, here is the break-even points between those two things. But instead of telling you, the borrower, to compute that, I would say it's me, the lender, who knows much more and has more data that I can help you make a decision.
Yeah. And have you uncovered any fundamental forces or drives shaping our decisions that we're not necessarily initially conscious or aware of?
So yeah, a lot, right? But the biggest one is, of course, emotions, right? And emotions are really interesting because they influence us in dramatic ways, but we don't always see them. So if I ask you to explain to me your choices, let's say, you know, let's look at some of your biggest financial choices in the last 3 years. Please explain them to me. You would certainly give me reasons that look like rational reasons. When we think about the world, we try to think about the world in an organized way. So we say, here's reason one, why I made this choice, and reason two, and reason three, and reason
hello,
four.
Hello, Dan, I can't hear you. You seem to cut out.
And we go ahead and we make the story as if those things really drove our decisions. But in reality, often what drove our decision are emotional components.
So last thing I heard was financial decisions and emotions.
Yeah. So you asked me what are the biggest elements within our nature that derail us from making decisions, and the biggest one is emotions. And imagine that I come to you and say, Jacob, let's look at the last 3 years. Let's look at the biggest decisions you've made in the last 3 years, and let's try and understand why you made those decisions. Now, what we are very good at is telling in retrospect why we made those decisions. I chose this car because of the ratio of distance to safety to cost, and I bought this microphone because of this features and this feature, and I bought this. The reality is that many of our decisions are emotion first, and then we make a decision, and then we tell stories about it. But the stories are after the fact, they're not the reasons. But these are often such good stories that we buy them as well. So emotions not only drive many of our decisions, the quickness in which we start talking about cognition hides from us their influence. Now, there's another interesting thing about emotion. Think about the emotion from an evolutionary perspective. Let's say fear from a tiger. Why would nature want you to have fear? What nature wants you to do is run away.
Yeah.
Why the fear? Nature wants you to see a tiger, run away. Why have an emotion at all? The story about emotion is that emotion in some cases is about the next behavior. So for this behavior, I want you to see a tiger and to start running. And then the fear can come later because the fear is supposed to prevent the next risky behavior. It's not about this one. This one I solved with you running already. So what we find is that there are lots of cases in which the emotion comes after the decision has been made. And it's not about that decision. It's about future decisions of, oh, let's not go to that part of the woods or something like that. So emotion is like reason number one. Mm. We are deeply emotional. It's part of our mechanism. And, now, just to be clear, emotion is also very beautiful. We fall in love. You know, that's not part of the rational decision making. We help people. If you see somebody suffering, your heart goes to them. You are able to feel a little bit their pain. This is all, not rational. And when somebody gives you an unfair offer, you get pissed off. not rational. When you see somebody stealing a bag from an old lady, you might run after them to try and stop them. So we're not rational in bad ways, and we're not rational in good ways. And the question, of course, is how do we get more of the good things, more love, more poetry, and so on, and less of the bad, and less of the bad things. Another thing that holds us back is our inability to think about the long term. Again, evolution didn't plan on us living 80-some, 90-some years. It didn't plan on us having jobs like the jobs we do. It didn't plan on us doing things like writing books and doing startups and so on. Lots of things were much more quick and short and so on. So we're not designed to think about that. The list goes on, but I'll give you one more interesting one. We are not designed to think about money.
Mm-hmm.
Money is a relatively new invention.
Mm. Statism,
it's a really strange,
that.
It's a really strange invention. It's a wonderful invention, right?
Yeah.
And probably the most important invention in human history, maybe more important than the wheel. You know, without money, we would all be farming something and trading off with other people. I would farm broccoli and I would find you and see how much broccoli you would charge me for rice or something like that. Money allows us to specialize, to save. Money is kind of amazing. It allows us to have long-term planning. It allows us to have very different profession. I couldn't teach as a job without money. So money is really amazing. But we're not designed to think about money. Sometimes in English, people have the term, say, it's a complex decision. It's like comparing apples and oranges. Psychologically, comparing apples to oranges is very easy. I can show you an apple and orange and say, hey, which one do you feel like? You know, in each moment, which one do you feel more like? But if I ask you an apple versus a dollar, that's a tough one. That's a tough one, right? Not only does it change depending on how hungry you are and so on, but what's the pleasure of a dollar? Like the pleasure of an apple versus the pleasure of an orange, I can tell. The pleasure of an apple versus a dollar? What? How am I supposed to think about this? I'm supposed to think about all the things I could get with a dollar? Now and later, if I saved it and got some interest rate and then compare the two, it's very, very hard to do. So money is what is called the common good. We're able to do lots and lots of things with it. That's where its greatness comes from. But it also means we have a really hard time thinking about money in rational terms. So we think about money in lots of irrational terms. So you can think about those as kind of the starting points: emotion, long-term thinking, money. I'm closing the light.
No worries, it's all good.
Okay. Just the sun is coming from the side.
Yeah. I've read so many times Naval's kind of tweet storm, how to get rich without getting lucky. And he often says people are playing status games when they should be playing wealth games, and they get more long-term benefit from wealth games. Is the reason why we're so attuned to our status from how we used to operate 10,000 years ago?
Of course. So do you know this joke that two guys are in a campsite and they are kind of still in the tent and they hear a bear? And one of them says, let's run. And the other guy said, you run, I'm putting my sneakers on. And he shouts at him and he says, you think a sneakers would make you outrun the bear? I said, no, I just need to outrun you. So when you think about society, there are lots of things that we are competing on position with our fellow men. And you're absolutely right. We compete on all kinds of things. Some of them make sense, some of them don't. But some of them are not very healthy. I'll tell you two stories about this. There's an interesting story about an animal called an elephant seal. And an elephant seal is a very hierarchical animal. And the males get to mate with the females. And it basically goes by size. So the biggest elephant seal gets to mate with almost all the females. The second, yeah, the third get a little bit, and then it drops off. So there's a competition to be the biggest elephant seal. In the process of getting bigger, they also become very unhealthy. Mm-hmm. So they die of heart problems. They die from vascular problems. Sometimes they crush the females when they copulate. But you know, if you were the third biggest elephant seals, would you say, hey, guys, let's calm down. Let's everybody lose 10% of our weight and we'll be all better off. No. You compete. Now, in an analogy to humanity, there was a very interesting analysis of the 2007-2008 financial crisis in the U.S. And what they looked at was housing. Now, in the U.S., housing taxes, real estate taxes, pay for education. So that means that if you move to a neighborhood that has high real estate value, the schools have more money and the schools in general are better. So if you're a parent, what do you want for your kids? Good schools. Where are good schools? Expensive properties. And what they showed is that out of caring for their kids, parents moved to expensive neighborhoods that they couldn't afford. And they bought houses that were too expensive for them. And as a consequence, they saw domestic violence, spousal abuse, and divorce rate. A little bit like the elephant seals, the competition on unlimited goods. You know, there are goods that everybody could get one. Like, everybody could get an iPhone in principle, or you know, there are things. But there are some things that are limited, and those things create competition that can be very, very unhealthy. Those are called positional goods. That now, we took money, and rather than seeing it as a means to an end for some life, we made it into a positional good. You know, how do I view myself? Did I get promoted? Do I make more money than you? Stuff like, very much part of our nature. That's how we fight. Not very healthy for us. Now, I don't know where you are in terms of your thinking about the economy, but lots of people are very worried about AI and unemployment. You know, and when there'll be more AI and more unemployment, let's just assume that that's the case. We're hoping that there'll be universal basic income, that we will not let people be broke and without health insurance and so on. We hope that we will develop some social safety mechanism, but social safety mechanism don't answer the question of where do people stand socially. Mm-hmm. So now we can ask the question, in a world in which 30% of the people are unemployed, what are people supposed to be proud of? Now, you can imagine it'll be two classes, the working class who have a mission and so on and this, and the universal basic income class. That's really not good for society to create that. We want people to wake up and be energized and feel they're contributing and find a sense of meaning. And so all the beautiful things about humanity, how do we do it in a world with 30% unemployment? By the way, one of the unresolved questions about universal basic income is that if you're on some unemployment benefit from the government, you can't feel good about it.
Yeah.
But it's defined as you're not doing well, we need to help you, and you have to admit that you're a failure in some degree to even apply for those benefits. And they force, and it's also not a nice process and so on. One of the hopes is that universal basic income would get people to stop being feeling shameful that they got there, right? To say, oh, no, it's just part of your right as a human being in this society. But that's just the first step. And then the next step would be to say, okay, how do we give people the energy to wake up and do things and feel that they are not just sucking society dry?
And surely if the universal basic income was a thing, then everyone who was on it, the bottom 51%, might just vote for the person who will give them 20,000 or 40,000 instead of 15,000 a year. Wouldn't that cause a lot of problems as well, maybe?
Okay. So now we're getting into the question of how democracy is working and how it should work and so on. So I'll tell you a following story. A couple of years ago, I called up all the Greek people I know quite a few. I wrote them all an email and I said, I want you all to apologize. I said, you brought us democracy. You sold it to us as a good idea. And, you know, let's agree. Not such a, I'm saying, I'm not blaming you. It was a good idea for a while. They had a good run, but you know, you didn't prepare us for this. And a few of my Greek friends said, you know, before you jump on Greek ideas, have you read much about Greek democracy? I said a little bit in high school, but truthfully, I don't remember. And they said, go back and read and come back. So I went and I read about Greek democracy. And Greek democracy was very interesting. They liked politics. They didn't like politicians. Mm-hmm. You know, the word party is from separating people to part. There were no parties. What they did was to use random mechanisms. I'll give you one example. All the citizens of Athens would meet in the morning and they would randomly pick who are going to be the judges today. That means that one day you could be the judge, one day you could be judged. One day you could be in this tribe, another year you could be in this tribe. They used randomness in order to give people the perspective of society and not just their own perspective. And that idea kind of died for a very long time until a few years ago, maybe 12 years ago or so, it was revived in Ireland. And Ireland had two interesting questions. One was about gay rights, and one was about abortions. Now, a country with complex religious issues, Catholic, Protestants, can you imagine a Catholic leader saying, okay, they can't, right? Politicians cannot compromise. For them, compromise is a dirty word. If you were my friend and you came to me for advice, I would never tell you never compromise. You say, oh, I have a problem with my girlfriend or with my wife, and never compromise, always. No. Life is all about compromise. Politicians can't compromise. So what did the Irish do? They went back to the Greek democracy and they set up citizen committees. They randomly selected hundreds of people. Randomly. So they represented everybody and they say, you guys are going to sit in a room for a while, once a week, for a long time, and you're going to start by talking among yourselves. you'll iron the issues out, you'll figure it out, you'll understand each other and so on. Then you'll invite experts. We will help you. And the experts will talk to you and explain things to you and so on. And at the end of this process, you will write your opinion. What should the country do? And then there'll be a referendum. Every citizen would vote and they will see whether yes or no. The two committees were in favor of gay rights and in favor of abortion rights. And people voted on that and they approved all of those things. And since then, there have been quite a few citizen committees in multiple countries around the world, more in Europe, but some in the US are starting. And in general, it's been a great mechanism.
Mm.
Now, there are two kind of interesting things. One is there's a German guy who's studying these topics, and he said something I really love. He said, people think that going to vote once every 4 years is to take responsibility. He said, no, 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 it's giving up responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Once every 4 years, you show up and you say, oh, I don't want to make decisions. You make decisions.
Yeah.
He said, no, no, no. Democracy is lots of work. It's lots of work. And we need to own it. That was one. The second thing is almost all the scholars in this area say that Brexit would not have happened if it was a citizen committee. In general, when people vote, they vote out of emotion and ignorance. Let's take the decision you proposed earlier. The universal basic income is giving me X and I want 2X. If you just make a gut decision and say 2X is more than 1X for me. But it's not a very thoughtful decision because you haven't thought about what else does it mean. The money will come from somewhere. It will change things, yeah. Right? What are you going to cut? So all of this is an answer to say that we can certainly have a version of modern democracy when people keep on making superficial emotional decisions. I want 2X more than 1X. But I actually think that people are quite thoughtful. And I think that if we did a citizen committee on how much money to give and what are the consequences and so on, I think even the people who could benefit from it will be thoughtful because they would say, my kids could be in my shoes, they could be in the other shoes. Let me understand the picture more generally. Let me be a bit more thoughtful about that. So I think that sadly, people make lots of irresponsible and not very thoughtful decisions in general, certainly not in the political domain, but I think we're capable. Hmm. And I think that citizen committees create the conditions to make much better decisions. So I'm more optimistic. But as you can see from all of our discussion today, I believe that to get humanity to a higher level, we need different mechanisms.
Yep.
Right? Like I'm saying, cars and people today, we can travel faster and better, but it's the combination. What is the car equivalent for better political decisions? Mm-hmm. That's the question. So I think we can do it, but if we do the social media version, of course, we'll make stupider decisions, but we can do the better ones.
Mm. It's like we have two choices, either to, like you said, improve society or limbically hijack society like social media has. Would the thing you're proposing about what the Greeks and the Irish have done in the past, is that almost like jury service where you could get called up randomly to make a decision on a policy, for example? Would that be That's what right. it would be like?
That's right. You would want more than 12 people. And because, by the way, part of the story is not just about that decision. Part of the story is about meeting people from other walks of life and starting to understand them in general, right? So it has the short-term effect of let's figure out what we want to do with recycling in this country, but it can also be the long-term effect on let's just get to know each other
mm-hmm.
a bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that that's a really important mechanism with lots of potential.
Definitely. I'd never even read about the Greeks politics as well. So that's a really cool idea. And what are some common traps modern people fall into when it comes to love and relationships? And why does this happen? I watched a really good video of yours that you made a few weeks ago about this and wanted you to explain.
So, of course, there's lots of things to say about love. But I think that one of the challenges with love is that we're afraid. One of the challenges with love is afraid. Is that when you tell somebody, I'm deeply in love with you. I can't imagine my life without you. When I leave you in the morning, I miss you already. And I don't think I could ever be as happy as I am with you right now. And I just want this to continue. If you say anything like this, you basically say, I'm vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And saying I'm vulnerable is really, really tough. I was recently with a friend, he's kind of early 60s, have a so-so relationship with his wife. And I told him, I said, look, could you write a 2-3 page love letter to your wife with all accurate things, but just about the part that you love her? Could you fill 2 or 3 pages? He said, no problem. She has lots of wonderful things that I love. And I said, if you wrote that letter to her and you gave it to her, or even better, read it to her out loud and then gave it to her, do you think it would improve your relationship for that evening and then maybe a little bit more in general? He said, absolutely. I think it would be an unbelievable gesture, and I think it will not only improve that evening, it will have an impact, and maybe she would write something. And then I asked him, can you bring yourself to write that? And he said, no. He said he was too hurt. He said he was too hurt. Now, this is an ego problem, right? It's an ego. And I'm not faulting him. You know, ego works in a certain way, and it's very tough to get over it. It's not easy. But here is somebody who says, I have enough material to write this. I know it will be good for me. I know it will be good for our relationship. He's also kind of an experimental guy. He should be able to do it just to see what happens. But he said, I can't do it. Like almost like a moral issue. I'm hurt. I'm offended. She should do the first step. And I'll give you kind of my rules for love. Okay. So my rules for love is the following. Rule number one, people basically love each other to the same degree. Imagine a scale from 0 to 100. People want to love at the same level. It's very unpleasant for you to love somebody very much and to feel the other person doesn't love. So love gravitates to loving at the same level. It could be here, it could be here, but it, you know, somebody is a little bit more, somebody a little bit less, but not big differences. That's the first rule of love. First, my rule of love could be wrong, but my version of it is that we gravitate toward loving with similar intensity. The second rule of love is that it's easier to love less than to love more. Mm-hmm. So if you're out of balance, the person who loves less could love more, or the person who loves more can love less. What's easier? For the person who loves more to love less, that's just an easier way to resolve this uncertainty. If I'm in relationship with you and I feel I love you much more, I can... You could feel uncomfortable with this and increase love, or I could feel uncomfortable and decrease love. Easier to decrease love. So you get this reduced approach. The third rule of love is that the scale we talked about before between 0 and 100 is not the right scale. As you get close to 0, you discover that there's more below 0. A very unpleasant space. The good news is as you get closer to 100, you discover there's a whole range above 100 as well. Now, if you think about all of this, it means that our role as romantic partners is to push for more love. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you're the one who loves more or you're the one who loves less. Love would always improve if you push it up. And at some point, if you push up, odds are that, you know, you'll get closer to the 100 and maybe discover more. And the last thing I'll say about this is that some people say relationships are work. And I really don't like this phrase. I like the phrase relationships are like a hobby. Mm-hmm. And work is about something that we have to do, but we don't enjoy.
Yeah.
And I think it's a terrible framework. Hobby is something we're not good at yet, but we enjoy the process and we want to get better. So I think that, you know, like pottery, I'm kind of imagining people doing pottery and, you know, this thing moves and it crashes and they learn how to do pottery. I think romantic love is like that. I think we need to enjoy the process, even when we crush, right? We need to enjoy the process and we need to try to get better with it for our own enjoyment, right? I think we should all become romantic connoisseurs. We say, oh, no, let me try this and try this and do this and do this. And not worry about the other person. It's not a competition. It's not, you know, and what am I doing? And are they reciprocating? No. How do we keep on pushing for more romantic activities?
Very wise. Very, very wise. And a final question. If you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be? Maybe the version of you that was struggling in the hospital or struggling, though, 2 or 3 years afterwards with the skin problems and the burns, what advice would you give to him? What would you say to him?
So, you know, life as somebody with disability and such a visible disability and pain, I still have daily pain, is very, very tough. I think one of my mistakes, sort of, was that for a long time, I was trying to live the life of somebody without my limitations and disability. I took on societal norms. I was a university professor, right? University professors are very rigid in what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to do it. It's like, you know, this is the role. Wasn't terribly rigid, but too rigid. I basically took on societal definition of what university professors should do, what I should do, and I try to live up to that. And those roles are often okay for people who are not physically injured and also neurotypical, right? So they're good for a subset of the people, but they define the normal operating mode. And it took me a while. It took me actually up to age 50 to realize this doesn't work for me and it doesn't work for anybody else, because if I try to fit myself into the standard, it's not good for me and it's not good for them. But it took me too long to get to that realization and to basically say, I just need not to care about what they expect university professors to do. And I need to figure out my own path. I wish I did it, you know, 10 years earlier, 20 years earlier, and so on. Every year earlier would have been better. So I would say this is, we said that injury is like a magnifying glass. I think it's very true for injuries. For injuries, you basically say, there are things you can do, there are things you can't do. Don't compare yourself to healthy people. You know, figure out your own standards. To a large degree, it's true for non-visible injuries like mental questions or cognitive questions or being a neuroatypical. But it's also true for people with different passions and different interests and so on. So in general, I think the advice is figure out your own strengths and weaknesses and try to override the societal. You can understand why society wants to define things very clearly, but it's not good for us, and it's especially not good for people who are extra different from the norm.
Very good advice, Dan. Very good advice. Dan Ariely, ladies and gentlemen, Dan, really appreciate this, and you have so many insights, and in my research, I found so many topics I want to explore. So I'd love to do a part two in the coming years. It'd be great. And what are you working on, and where can people go if they want to find your work?
So I have a website, danarielly.com, D-A-N-A-R-I-E-L-Y. I'm working now on a book about why I think we don't take enough risk in life and how I think we should take more risk. And then in the last 4 years, I've been studying the last chapter of people's lives. I've been studying the chapter from when people get diagnosed with terminal illness until the end of life. It's slightly longer than 5 years on average. And I've been trying to understand what are all the mistakes people make in this chapter and how can we fix them. And 9 weeks ago, actually today, my mother passed away.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
She decided when to end things. I mean, we helped her in her own, I'm very proud of her and proud of how we helped her, but it's also tough.
Yeah.
So I'm also writing a lot about, so I have this project on risk, but now I'm trying to digest the last period of my mother's life, what I've learned from her, what I've learned in general, kind of understand my own mourning and sadness. So those are the things that occupy most of my time these days.
Mm, that's beautiful. Do you think you'll end up doing a book on the final chapters of people's lives, do you think?
I don't know. Usually my writing is something I know already and I just try to explain it. Mm-hmm. Here I'm writing to understand. So I'm now at my mother's house. It's almost sunset. And on sunset she used to get us to stop whatever we were doing and go to the porch and have a glass of wine and watch the sunset. We're just by the ocean, so we can see the ocean. So I'm thinking a lot about her, trying to digest, trying to understand, and the writing is right now it's more of a process of understanding. We'll see what will come of it.
Well, I can't wait to hopefully see it if you do release it, and I'll leave the links to all your work in the show notes for everyone to absorb, because it's fantastic. Your books are amazing. You're amazing. Thank you so much for joining me, Dan.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I'm sure we'll do another round at some point.
Awesome. If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally, because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast, because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.